only true champions come out and show their worth after defeats. A quote by the great Sir Alex Ferguson, the greatest manager of all time. Today I'm joined by somebody who I perceive as a true champion. Hello and welcome to Rolling Start, a series of podcasts with role models. The podcast will be with people who have influenced and inspired me and others in their personal and professional life, who have had to deal with challenges and hurdles and still managed to succeed professionally. People who have shown resilience to achieve excellence both professionally and on a personal level. As they have inspired me and many others, we wanted to try and share some of these personal stories to a wider audience so that others can too be inspired by these role models. Today, as I say, I'm joined by a true champion, Ryan Pereira, Global Director, Gas and LNG at Gaffney Klein & Associates. A friend, somebody who has been like a brother to me since we started doing our economics degree together at Warwick University almost 20 years ago. Now a father, a husband, somebody who lives their life in the moment, a family man, somebody who balances social, work and religion better than anybody that I know, somebody who always remains positive, a true champion. Welcome, Ryan, to Rolling Start.
Thanks very much for that extremely warm welcome, and it's an honour and privilege to be here with you this afternoon.
Tell us about what you do. I've never really understood it, so yeah, it'd be helpful to understand exactly what your role is professionally at the moment.
Some days I'm actually still figuring out exactly what it is I do, but more importantly, it's really difficult after 17 years in the oil and gas industry since we finished our degree at Warwick at university. And in the past 6 years, I've been engaged and I've been working for an oil and gas consultancy, as you say, Gaffney Klein & Associates. So it's a really tough question to explain, really. So my current role, as you said, my title is the Global Director of Gas and LNG. What does that actually mean? Well, it may be worthwhile starting off by explaining about gas and LNG. Gas, in its real form, is essentially the fuel that you use to heat your homes and the power that we use to generate our electricity around the world. Now, the problem with gas is that it's often in a part of the market where it's easy, it's not nearer to the consumers. So liquefied natural gas, or LNG is the acronym, is effectively gas just cooled down to minus 162 degrees Celsius, in which the process it actually involves means that it occupies 1/600th of the volume of natural gas, and therefore a larger quantity can be transported across the world. So I still haven't told you what that actually means. Well, our role is to provide commercial and technical advice to clients across the world. That's regarding their investment decisions. So let me draw a little bit of an analogy to maybe make it easier to understand. If you consider a property surveyor or somebody who advises on houses, they often advise buyers, sellers, lenders, and borrowers on a range of things, such as valuations, costs, risks, economics, and also returns, as well as many other things. Well, actually, in my line of business, we're not advising on the buying and selling of houses, but that of gas fields, pipelines, ships, power stations, and increasingly in today's market where you have concerns about climate and environment, on the energy transition, gas's role in that, and carbon management. The main difference in that analogy is that whereas houses, for example, in London may range from 400,000 or so to about 40 million for the upper ends, what we're talking about in the investments that we're dealing with ranges from $40 million to $40 billion. So hopefully that just clarifies some of the myths around what I actually do.
I finally understand it. Thank you. We did economics together at Warwick University, and a number of people went into banking or went into finance-related jobs. Obviously, there's a link to finance in your role, but not many people went into the oil and gas industry. Is this something that you were always interested in? Or did you simply fall into that as a overall career?
Yeah, I mean, oil and gas for me, it wasn't something that was planned. It wasn't something that was pre-plotted. Actually, if you had asked me what I wanted to be when I was a lot younger, you know, when I was growing up, when I was little, I probably would have said a pilot or for many years a snooker player. I used to practice endlessly on a 6-foot table crammed into the front lounge at home. And actually originally about probably one of those 12-inch tables that you get for Christmas. Unfortunately, I wasn't the next Stephen Hendry or Jimmy White at the time. So I do actually admire those, you know, who go into their career knowing exactly what it is that they want to do. But hopefully, as you through the course of this podcast, what you'll see is that my experience shows that you don't always need to be clear on your final destination or your definition of what you want to do. So let me backtrack a little bit. Leaving university or towards the end of university, there were three main roles I was exploring as everyone was looking, as you said, for banking, investment banking roles and finance graduate programs coming out of the economics degree at Warwick. So my first experience was sitting doing a telephone interview in my halls of residence at Warwick. And I remember it clearly. It was an interview for BUPA or BUPA, however you pronounce it, for their grad scheme. I thought I was fairly well prepared, but in fact, I wasn't. Whilst I was prepared on the economics and the financials and all those hard numbers, they asked me what BUPA actually meant. I didn't know. I didn't get the job. My second main interview actually came with investment banking through various rounds, and I eventually got an offer from a top London bank here in London, but also a big US bank. However, during that interview process, whilst I prepped for that and I was coached for that by some very good role models, I didn't enjoy it one bit. That offer came through at 25% higher financial incentive than the actual role that I took in the end, but I decided to decline it. In the end, looking back, that was a great decision. So therefore, into the oil and gas role, how do I get into oil and gas? Well, actually, I applied for the finance graduate program at a range of oil and gas companies, but actually ended up proceeding through the roles at ExxonMobil. What this really taught me was the power and importance of a good network. Because believe it or not, 2 days before my interview, I hadn't really realised that ExxonMobil was one of the largest companies in the world and the largest traded on the stock indexes. So what that showed me from a very early stage was the importance of a good network and the fact that people are often more important than reading company websites. So since that time, if you look at my career in oil and gas, I've never really looked back. I've worked hard. I've also been blessed with good timing and fortune.
I was thinking about, you mentioned your coaches and people that you kind of coach you through the interview process. And you also spoke about networks and the importance of networks. Just want to understand a bit more about that. You know, you come from networks and building good networks are usually associated with people who have got a lot of links already into business. Something that I've always admired about you is your ability to reach out to other people and start to create these networks. So I'm wondering, what do you think it is about you that allows you to do that?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, one that involves you looking at yourself, which is something that a lot of us don't always do. I don't see myself as anything special, but what I do always see is that people, no matter what their level is, are just people at the end of the day. So I don't mind approaching people who may be seen to be at a higher level than me. But even from a school days, you know, I was always keen to help those people who perhaps weren't as skilled academically as I was, didn't have the opportunities that I did, perhaps didn't work as hard as I did. I always wanted to help people to bring them up in our community.
Tell me a bit about the experience you had at BUPA. You mentioned that you didn't get the role. I think one of the important things of interviewing and actually just going through life in general is that you learn from those experiences. So what are the key things you learned from that BUPA experience?
I think one of the key things I learned is that you'll get knockbacks. And whilst you want every job that you tend to apply for, that won't always be the case. And it wasn't the case for me. Even from GCSEs and applying for jobs during your GCSEs and A-levels, I didn't get every job that I wanted to go for. Every graduate role was precious. And I see that pressure on graduates in today's world. And especially in today's economy, as we're sitting today, job interviews are hard. You know, if you look at the ratio of roles that you have to apply for to get one, it's really challenging. So I think for me, the key lesson is don't take every rejection as a knockback and as the end of the road. And I was talking to a friend about this just last night, actually. One of the words of wisdom that I often get from my dad, who passed away a few years ago, was that even if it doesn't seem like it at the time, things will always happen for the best. And I carry that forward when I have knockbacks today, and I just think things will happen for the best.
When was the last time you did have a knockback?
Actually, I mean, the most recent time was just this morning. So I mentioned to you a few weeks back that we had our first child a couple of years ago, and we're expecting our second child. So the pregnancy test and everything came through positive, and we were quite excited by that. And We also knew during, because of what happened with our last child who was born 3 months prematurely, that human life is so fragile. Even when you're pregnant, you know, nothing's guaranteed. And so today, just this morning, you know, the past few weeks, the pregnancy's been a bit unsettled. We went for a scan a couple of weeks ago, and they said it was potentially too early stage to actually give a positive result for a positive pregnancy in terms of a viable pregnancy. And just this morning, I actually went with my wife, and we actually took our baby daughter, Erin, to St. Mary's Hospital. And they confirmed that, you know, unfortunately, we had had a miscarriage. And I say we because both of us had gone through it, and we'd gone through it as a family, although obviously the impact on a female's body is much more than it was on mine. So when you say when was the last time I had a knockback, a few hours ago, really. Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. Just thinking about that, you know, how do you feel about that now? And then kind of looking forward, I always say it's always amazing how you have such a positive view on life. How do you remain so positive when you get a knockback like that?
It's not easy, right? So life in general is not easy. But I always try and put it into context. And I think many things have put that into context through me. I'm lucky and I'm blessed to have a family and upbringing that I did. And I'm lucky and blessed to have role model parents, as I did with my dad and as I still have with my mum. But as we think about it, you know, for me, I always look around and see people that are actually worse off. That's one for starters, because no matter how bad your situation is, you can always see somebody out there if you just open your eyes and see somebody in a worse position than you. Secondly, I look at my dad. My dad was fit, healthy, had a bigger beer belly than I do, and he retired at the age of 65. He had a really happy life, a great happy life with my mum. And at the age of 68, he suddenly got weaker. He lost some strength. He was able to carry a 20, 30 kilogram suitcase. And we went to Canada and he wasn't able to do that. He got short of breath. His posture changed. And the medical staff in Leicester couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. Anyway, I brought him down to physio. And a good friend of mine a few years later on now, who I know, called it Amin. He is a physio. And he said to my dad, go and straight see a neurologist when you get back to Leicester. As soon as he did that, my dad was diagnosed with MND, or motor neuron disease, which is also known in the States as ALS. And over the course of 19 months, we saw my dad's position deteriorate further, from not being able to carry a suitcase to gradually declining walking, struggling with breathing, being on a machine overnight, and having many medical appointments in there. What was interesting to me was that my dad, throughout this whole process, was just accepting. He always said, let's do things according to God's will. So when my dad finally declined, even to the final day, I saw him 4 days before he passed away. And at that time, I actually got upset and I actually cried in front of my dad because I said to him, I think you're dying, Dad. You know, you need to keep fighting. You used to be a boxer. You need to keep fighting. And he said, I'll try my best. And he was such a strong character. Whilst I had tears in my eyes, he was still strong. I remember seeing him driving off as he stood at the window. That was to be the last time I saw him. 4 days before he passed away. I remember his final text message to me. He said to me, trust in God's plan. It's hard times, but trust in God's plan. At that point in time, people said to me, you and your family have experienced so much tragedy to date. We looked at it in a different way. Again, I said, we put it into context. Others are in a much worse place. Fast forward, if I could, to the third experience, and I just talked briefly about Erin, our boy daughter, who was born 2 years ago. Very trying circumstances. She was born at 27 weeks and 3 days, weighing just 2 pounds or 920 grams. People feared for her life. Again, there were people in that, babies in that hospital, twins that were born at 500 grams. But in our situation, in the crux of the matter, this was the worst case that we could have seen in the pregnancy. Friends and family around us were fretting. Prayers were offered. People, messages of support were coming, flying through the door. But we stuck through to my dad's message and said, trust in God's plan. Thankfully, Erin, through the exceptional medical staff and the care of the neonatal team at St. Mary's Unit, lived to survive the tale. And today she's a happy, bouncing baby, equally with a big beer belly. So that must be a trait in the family.
And then just looking back over those three times in particular, is there anything that stands out as something that you would have done differently if you had the time over again?
It's really... really interesting to think about it in terms of that way, because as you said in the introduction, I it may be to my detriment sometimes. I live for the moment. You know, I'm quite an impulsive type of guy in our interactions, in our WhatsApp group. You know, I send comments off the handle, which often gets me in a bit of trouble in my home life as well. But thinking back to anything you live differently, and I think just actually expressing that love and actually telling your close ones how much you love them on a day-to-day basis is really important. And it's not something that I'm good at. You know, I find it really hard to tell those closest to me that I love them. I do love them, you know, and I show them that in a day-to-day basis. But do I say to my mum, do I hug my mum? Do I love my mum? Do I say that to her? No, I don't. So maybe that's something that I'll do differently. But I think in terms of my kind of coping formula, if you want, if you think about that, getting through those experiences for me personally is something that I've developed over time. And I always say to my closest friends and family is that my personal formula are three main things. One is my faith. Secondly is music. And the third thing is exercise. Let me talk a little bit about each of those in turn very briefly. The faith really comes from my grandma. That's my dad's mum, who instilled prayers, who taught us prayers from an early age and always said, you know, whatever you do, pray to God. My parents then instilled that faith in us. And of course, going to a Catholic comprehensive primary school and a Catholic comprehensive secondary school, that was something that was drilled into us and instilled in us and has served me really well. Secondly, music. Whilst you might not agree with my taste of music, and I follow some of your music traits, one of the best things I've bought in life happened to be a Sonos speaker. And we always say in our house, we've got one upstairs and one downstairs, and we tend to have that on every morning and every evening playing music. And the final thing is exercise. Going to the gym, I meet so many what I call regular, everyday, day-to-day people. And that really motivated me about 5 years ago now to start up a virtual WhatsApp group across all the continents. And that's been running now for just over four, maybe 4.5 years. And it's got people from as far afield as Australia to Canada to London to my hometown of Leicester. And that group's fluctuated over time. But today we're for about a group of about 20 people. And we motivate each other today, day to day, to do exercises. But of course, with that personal coping strategy, I think anyone who says that they get through these kind of tragedies alone is either a phenomenally exceptional person or they're not really recognizing the support network. And for me, I've not been alone in getting through these challenges. That support network has come from family and friends and people like you.
I think support networks are so important. And as much as I've supported you, you've supported me as well. So I really appreciate that. So you mentioned support networks, and one of the biggest support networks that you've had is family and friends, but a number of people clearly don't have that. What advice would you give to people to really help them to build out their networks, knowing how important that support system can be?
That observation that you made is so astute, because I always know that I'm so lucky to have the family and the friends that I do have. And I have seen people out there. I've engaged in a lot of voluntary work. So I was a trustee for a charity in Westminster for a period of 5 years. And that enabled me to see the hardships and the troubles that people go to on a day-to-day life. People that haven't got anybody. People like the isolated, the elderly, the young, the poor, you know, the deprived in that circumstance. That's my advice to them, is that don't lose hope. You know, there is always someone out there that will be willing. There are a lot of good people in today's world, even though we're brought up to think people are strangers, don't trust strangers. But actually, if you ask the common man or woman on the street, there are a lot of people out there that will stop and help you. So I think my first message would be, don't lose hope. You know, somebody will help you. The second thing is, find something that takes your passion and interest. And if you do want to connect with people, try and connect with their passions and interests, because people love talking about what it is that they do, what it is that they like, or what it is that they're passionate about. And that really is the thing that would enable you to form the links in life. But I think, you know, there are people out there that are just in such terrible, terribly difficult situations. And like I said, you know, it's always hard to resonate, and it's always easy to try and look at things from other people's perspective. And I can't say I've been in those worst of worst situations. So for me to give concrete advice on that is actually quite difficult. So I think one of the main things I'd say to people in that situation, as you described, is don't lose hope. There's always somebody out there that will be willing to help you. Just have to reach out. And I think, don't go into despair. You know, don't put yourself down. Don't use drugs. Don't use alcohol, even though how easy it is to do to fall into those traps, and it happens. But try and reach out to somebody. You know, try not to deal with everything by yourself.
So you grew up in Leicester. Leicester was a very interesting place in the early 2000s, so to speak, as a start of the millennium. There was a lot of it's a very multicultural city. There's a lot of different races there, a lot of kind of ethnic, it felt like ethnic tension. I just wanted to understand what it was like for you as a Goan heritage growing up in Leicester, and your experiences of race and ethnicity as you grew up.
As you rightly say, you know, you experienced Leicester on a few occasions, and I was born and raised there and still travel home, what I call home, every few weeks, actually. It is extremely cosmopolitan. And the first thing I find is funny is that you mentioned my Goan heritage, because being brown, being Asian, you go to school or you go to meet new people and they say, what's your name? And you say, Ryan. And they say, okay, so what's your Indian name? And you look at it and say, I'm actually Catholic, I'm Goan, it's a Portuguese colony, and you explain it to them and they suddenly understand it. And then they say, oh, so you haven't got an Indian name. And this actually comes from Indians. So it's really bizarre to note that. But the racial divide and things like that that people talk about is not something that I would say impacted me immensely, at least in my early years. But now, as I've gotten older, I do notice some divides in the community, and that's become more and more noticeable over time. And maybe that's the process of getting older and looking at things through a slightly different lens. But very interestingly, again, you look at that, and actually those divides and those conflicts and those tensions are actually within the same minority groups, bizarrely enough, not amongst different minority groups. Diversity, to give you an example about that, and it's something that's talking about a lot in today's world, takes me back to a story of childhood innocence. But actually today in Leicester, whilst I hate, one of the things I hate doing is going out smelling of any types of food, let alone curry. Before a night out at a bar or a nightclub, a lot of my what I class as white friends actually eat more curry than I do. And they actually want to go to a curry before a night out on a few beers or a club. And I'm completely against that. So that perhaps shows you a little bit about how Leicester's changed over the years.
What have been the most challenging things that you've had to deal with in the workplace?
I think in the workplace, it's about, you know, proving yourself. You're constantly out there to prove yourself. People are looking for people to get promoted, or at least that's the aim. You know, you're getting there as a graduate and you think, where can I go to next? You know, what do I want to rise to? And in that circumstance, I think one of the most challenging experiences, if I look back right to the start of working life in terms of a proper full-time employment, was when I started at ExxonMobil, because Aaron passed away in June 2003. And our first day at work was 1st of September 2003, which was obviously 3 months later. So not only did I start a new job, but I was moving to London. As you know, we lived in the same flat. We had to find a place to a completely new place. We had new surroundings. We had a new environment. We were no longer in the bubble of Warwick University. So that was quite challenging. For the first 6 months, I really underperformed. I just wasn't into it, because whilst I put things in perspective, I probably went too much the other way. And I just said to myself, well, actually, why does work matter? My brother's just died. I've lost a lot. My family's lost a lot. But actually, when I started to think about it, and I had a couple of chats with my boss and my coworker at the time, my colleague, they actually said, you know, there's something not quite right there, Ryan. And I turned it around. And in the period after that, I wanted to do my brother's legacy proud. He was always proud of what I achieved. So I really started to work a lot harder, and I started to achieve much better results. And from there, things started to fly. Of course, in my 5 years at ExxonMobil, there were challenges of always appearing young. You know, people always looked at you as a young graduate. When I joined Centrica, of course, they didn't see the mistakes that you made and the learning that you had as a graduate coming new into a company. So you were there as a more robust person. Perhaps one of the biggest mistakes I avoided making, actually, was 2 months into my role at Centrica, where we were looking at a number of large M&A gas deals. And I was in a meeting with the main finance director, who used to oversee a lot of things. And this meeting was supposed to start at 4 and end at 5. And that was really important to me, not because I always wanted to leave on time, because that was the evening of the Champions League final, United against Chelsea. And I desperately wanted to get back to this game, to watch the build-up, to watch, have a few beers, and actually to watch the game. 4 o'clock till 5 o'clock turned into 6 o'clock, turned into 6:30, at which point I was getting increasingly nervous about missing the start of the game. And me being me, I actually wanted to say to the finance director, Andrew, who actually was claimed to be a United fan, look, the game's going to kick off, we're missing the build-up. But I kept quiet. 6:30 turned to 7:30, turned to 7:45, which was the kickoff time, which turned to 8, which turned to 8:15, and I just bit my lip, at which point Andrew said, look, there's not enough work that's been done by the tax and the legal team on this. We're going to stop the process, we're not going to bid. Everyone go home and come back tomorrow. I breathed a sigh of relief. I was really annoyed that I missed the first half, but obviously it was all overturned when I got back. And actually we won that final and John Terry slipped and United, the rest, as they say, is history. But the funny thing about that was I actually learnt a big lesson from that to bite my tongue, because often I can speak out quite a lot and I've done that in the past and I'm sure I'll do it in the future. But that was one occasion which, as they say, could have been extremely career limiting move. But thankfully in that occasion I stayed quiet. And I missed the first half of the football, but we won.
You mentioned Manchester United, and I think this is a good segue. A quote from Eric Cantona, who we actually went to see live in audience, as you know, is you can choose your wife, you can choose your politics, you can choose your religion, but never, never can you choose your football team. Obviously, we are a season ticket holder at Manchester United. What does football give you in addition to the work and the family? You know, what does it give you?
This is where a lot of our friendship and our catch-up chats has really revolved around the football, right? So if I look back to where that love originally came from, it's actually from my dad and from my uncles and through several cousins who have supported United. And at school, you've got this football banter. So from the early days, now, if you look back at it, people say as a United fan, oh, you're a glory seeker, you are, you know, you could support United for all these years. But actually, when you reflect on it, when do you first know about football? It's probably when you're about 5, 6 years old, maybe 7, 8. And at that point in time, both you and I were 1988, we were 6 years old. And United, as you know, were pretty terrible at that time. So at the time, we couldn't really afford to go to games. My dad couldn't really afford to take us to the games. We didn't really have that many connections in a network. But as you said, now we're fortunate enough to hold that season ticket. And that's taught me many things, because as we go to that game, those games, you rightly said that United is in your blood. You know, it's a belief. It's a religion more than anything. And we've experienced many highs and many lows. But what it's given me over and above the work and the school and the university life is it's enabled us to form many friendships and many special bonds and many memories. And I remember thinking back 11 days before my dad passed away. We didn't know he was going to pass away, but this was one of his final games at Old Trafford. And the care and the attention and the love that the stewarding team actually showed to my dad, I don't think you'd get the same in London. So I've got a lot of affinity with the Manchester people for that. Of course, he passed away 11 days before, but one of the lasting memories was me, my mum, my dad in the stadium, pretty much alone with the groundsman mowing the lawn. But what you and I will both experience is that there are just genuine, everyday, day-to-day people from a range of walks of life in that stadium, all with the same belief and passion. And for me, that's something that's really important.
You mentioned a number of times God's will, prayer, religion. You go to church on pretty much every Sunday. How has religion impacted your life overall?
I think the first thing to clarify with that is that I'm not the best role model Catholic. So I've made a lot of mistakes. People would say I've committed a lot of sins. And on a day-to-day basis, you know, I wouldn't say I'm a role model Catholic. As you know, I'm the godfather to your daughter and her, and I'm also godfather to 5 other children around the world. So that for me is quite an honour. What church gives me is it gives me that chance to reflect. So even if I go there for an hour every week, it's a commitment. And even if I'm not deep in prayer, sometimes your mind does wander, but it gives you that chance to reflect. And many times when I'm in church, I'm not actually praying for my own cause. I'm thinking about others who have perhaps been in hardships and difficulties, some of the people that you mentioned earlier in this discussion, those people who are struggling in life. And I'm thinking that these are the people who need the intercession. These are the people that need the help. So faith to me has given me something to hold on to. It gives me, you know, a philosophy, if you want, to follow. But of course, a lot of that's in the practice of the religion. Every religion's got its pros and cons and its flaws. But I think one thing that draws me towards all religions and why I respect all religions is that the common belief of all of them is the ability and the will and actually the feeling to want to do good and to help fellow humans. And I think that today is the most important thing in our world. It's the most important thing that we need today, given all the various problems that we have in today's world. It's that affinity to love your neighbour, your stranger and everybody else, and actually just go that step beyond and try and help somebody else, which is, I think, what you're trying to achieve by this series of podcasts which you're releasing.
Just thinking about when you first got into the workplace, a lot of people who, particularly from diverse backgrounds, they have a challenge with always feeling internally like they're a fraud. So even when they're delivering, they always feel like they shouldn't be in that position, often called imposter syndrome. Just wondering whether you ever experienced that. And I suppose, what advice would you give to somebody who is experiencing that?
It's funny, like, you mentioned imposter syndrome, because it actually came up just a couple of weeks ago, you know, when we were discussing it. And I actually had to clarify with you what you meant by imposter syndrome. So when I first thought about it, my first answer is, I don't really know what imposter syndrome is, so no, I can't have experienced it. But then I started to reflect on it and I thought, well, maybe I have experienced it. And I think the two perhaps greatest times where I experienced what you might call imposter syndrome is times where I've had to present or to meet clients on an area which is not in my core area for expertise. And the other time is because generally I look relatively young in what I do. And a lot of the people in the oil and gas industry have got more experience than I do, and they've got more grey hairs than I do. I've got a few in my beard forming now since the baby was born. So I have experienced imposter syndrome, if you put it into those contexts. In terms of my advice to other people and how I deal with it, is that we always have to remind ourselves that everybody started somewhere knowing nothing. So when you're trying to help people or when you want help, remember that that person that you're advising or that you're giving advice to, at one point in time, you were in their exact same shoes. So with that, the other aspect is, wherever you are in your career or your life, always be humble. And I'm so lucky, actually, because at the moment and for the past 6 years, and I've known this man for a long time before that as well in my previous company, I've had a perfect role model manager who's actually more than a manager. He's what I'd determine as a true leader. This guy's a guy called Nick, who's 63 years of age, 35 plus experience in the oil and gas industry, knows everything about oil and gas and knows everything about the world. He's got the brain the size of a planet. But he always sits down with the younger generation, with his own generation, and he's always willing to coach people, to work through things with you, and he never assumes that he knows more than you do. So again, my advice to other people, no matter what stage of your career that you're at, is to be like Nick. Be that perfect leader, be that perfect role model, and always be willing to give of yourself as you're willing to receive of other people. And I think the final thing, as I'm talking, I was thinking about this, is that imposter syndrome, I guess, is something I'm experiencing on a day-to-day basis as a new dad, because you wake up some days or you come across some experiences, like changing nappies, like feeding, like educating them, dropping off at nursery, picking up from nursery. And really speaking, every day as a dad, I guess I'm an imposter.
Thank you, Ryan. I'll end again with that quote that I started with. Only true champions come out and show their worth after defeat. That's a quote from the great Alex Ferguson, the greatest manager of all time. Today, I've had the pleasure of talking with a true champion. Ryan, thank you for coming onto Rolling Start.
Justin, it's been fantastic. I'd like to say thank you immensely for the opportunity to come and have this discussion with you. and look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Ryan, we've come to the end of the podcast, unfortunately. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story. I hope you've all enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. If you've been inspired by Ryan's story, please go to rollingstart.org.uk for more information. On the next episode, we'll be speaking to Mike Masuka, who talks to us about his personal journey, as well as his coveted CV from ITV to Sega to Halo, and now in the senior role in what is one of the truly global institutions of our time in Apple. Thank you so much for joining us. See you next time.